Carl Grossman, his recent piece, Why Is There More Media Talk About Using Nuclear Weapons Than About Banning Them?, can be found on FAIR.org, and you can also follow his work on carlgrossman.com. Carl Grossman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
A pleasure, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll turn to Carter Doherty of Americans for Financial Reform about what the carried interest tax loophole is and how, thanks to Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, it survived yet another legislative attempt to close it. Then Kelly Hayes of the Fairness Project will analyze the victory for abortion rights in Kansas and how it can be replicated in states around the country to restore the reproductive medical care that right-wing Supreme Court justices have stripped away. Finally, historian and academic Robin D.G. Kelly joins me to commemorate the 20th anniversary edition of his seminal book, Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The United States Senate on Saturday passed the Inflation Reduction Act, a sprawling bill on climate, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and taxes. Extracting a steep price for her support of the bill, Arizona's Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema demanded that a provision cutting back the carried interest loophole be removed. That loophole has enriched private equity executives for years and survived multiple legislative attempts to thwart it, thanks to intense lobbying by the financial industry. We turn now to Carter Doherty, who is the Communications Director at Americans for Financial Reform. Welcome to the program, Carter.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
What is the carried interest tax loophole? It, I know it can be sort of wonky to get into the details of it, but if you can explain in layperson's terms what it is and where it originated, when did it come about? How is it that we have this thing?
Sure. This is the sort of thing most of us would rather not know about or have to know about, but unfortunately there are a lot of really rich people profiting off it, and it is patently unjust. The carried interest loophole is a function of the tax code that a professor by the name of Victor Fleischer pointed out in an article in 2007, where he explained how private equity executives were exploiting the difference between the income tax rate and the tax rate on capital gains, which is to say, on the increase in a value of an asset, were taxed. And he noticed that private equity executives were taking something that was legitimately their labor income, as they say, but classifying it as capital gains income and therefore paying a lower tax rate. And they were paying a lot lower taxes on a lot of money. And just to give you a sense of this, there is one guy, Steven Schwarzman at Blackstone, the largest private equity firm in the world, who paid a lower tax rate on $78 million worth of income in 2021. And that is due to this longstanding loophole, which Congress has been unable to close. And all told, it's probably a good guess that about $18 billion each year is not paid to the federal government because of this loophole. But again, it's a loophole that benefits people personally. It benefits rich people personally. It's not about their companies. It's about them being personally more rich than they already are.
I mean, it's incredible. During this talk of inflation being such a problem, we are told by media pundits, by some politicians, that it's because ordinary people have too much money in their pocket. No one really brings up that other I word, which is inequality, and the fact that rich people keep getting more and more money in their pockets. So why did Kyrsten Sinema object to undermining or reducing this carried interest tax loophole? What's her interest?
Well, it's worth noting a little context about Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, which is she is somebody who went from being a globalization critic and demonstrator at major gatherings in the 1990s of the World Bank and the IMF and associated free trade gatherings to being a friend of the private equity industry as a senator. She's had quite a journey. And the truth is, we don't really get a lot about why Kyrsten Sinema doesn't like efforts to close this loophole. It's worth noting that her only explanation in person, as opposed to through a spokesperson, was at a fundraiser last week that she held on Capitol Hill around the time that this legislation was being considered. So we don't often get the courtesy of an explanation from Kyrsten Sinema, but to the extent that we got some indication of why she was opposed to it, it had to do with her insistence that this would somehow be bad for small businesses, for investment in small businesses. And she essentially kind of bought a line that the private equity industry has fed us for a while, that any increase on taxes on private equity will result in less investment in small businesses, which is absolute nonsense. Just to give you a sense, private equity is are big pots of money that Wall Street puts together to buy companies, known as leveraged buyouts. Most of those buyouts are above $500 million. So that is not a small business by anyone's definition. And yet they sort of hide behind this fig leaf of it being all about small businesses.
Wow.
And then you scratch a little deeper, Sonali, and you see all sorts of indicators of a politician on the take. Sinema has taken what's probably millions of dollars in campaign contributions from the private equity industry. We don't know the precise details of that. We don't know about the dark money spent on her behalf by private equity. We do know that in 2020, she actually, as a sitting senator, no less, had an internship at a winery owned by a private equity baron.
Wait, so what? A sitting senator in the United States Senate took an internship at a winery?
I am not making that up. I am not making that up. She was an intern who did all sorts of things, apparently, like taste grapes and crush grapes and learn about wine and everything. And she did it. It was a paid internship. It showed up on her financial disclosures, and eventually the media got wind of it. But that is how close Kyrsten Sinema is to private equity.
Wait. So I sort of cut you off because I was shocked. But make the connection between the winery and private equity.
Well, whether it's geographically in close proximity to private equity or by virtue of the campaign contributions, it's pretty clear that Sinema has a very tight relationship with Wall Street private equity, which includes some of the richest people in the world.
So, and even, you know, the mainstream media has covered the fact that she does receive contributions from the very people who benefit from keeping this carried interest tax loophole. Wouldn't closing this loophole have helped to pay for the cost of this bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, that, you know, although not nearly going as far enough as the Build Back Better bill, does have climate provisions and other things that actually help Americans as a whole? That, you know, we could have had those billions of dollars per year in revenue, right?
We could have. It's important to remember that the carried interest loophole would net, you know, they were looking at around $18 billion. And by the way, what was proposed was simply a reform of this. It certainly wasn't an abolition of it. So it was a sort of watered down reform, and even that was too much for Sinema. But the broader point is that you have an amount of money which is, by your standards, by my standards, by any reasonable human being standards, a lot of money. But in the grander scheme of funding the federal government, it's a relatively small amount of money. And when you weigh that against the fact that this money is megabucks for individuals, for a small number of already very rich people who have lobbyists and make campaign contributions and all that, you see this sort of asymmetry there, where the forces in favor of keeping it end up stronger than the ones that want to get rid of it, especially when you hold the allegiance of a single senator from Arizona who is willing to do the bidding of private equity.
And we know that Sinema enjoys being, holding up legislation. This is something she's done before, like her colleague Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who had held up who basically stymied climate talks and then backed this so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which doesn't have that much to do with inflation. And all of this comes down to the fact that Democrats have an extremely slim hold over the United States Senate, which then allows just, one or two senators to hold the whole country, if you will, hostage. There were a whole bunch of other amendments, including progressive ones by people like Senator Bernie Sanders, that the Senate managed to beat back over the weekend, right?
That's right. And, to be fair, there are arguably some elements there that will have an impact on inflation. It's a sort of wide variety of measures. One thinks in particular of the efforts to bring down the cost of pharmaceuticals,
right,
for people on Medicare. So we can't entirely discount that aspect of the legislation. But the fact of the matter is, once Senator Manchin made his deal with Senator Schumer, there was very little room for changing the legislation. And to his credit, Senator Manchin is actually a longtime critic of the carried interest loophole.
Right.
He's a millionaire CEO, but he was not a finance CEO, and he regards it as sort of, a tax trick that you should get rid of. It was really Senator Sinema, who was the key to getting that done, and she didn't want to get it done, presumably because her rich patrons didn't want to get it done.
So there's, all sorts of cynical joking about how this carried interest tax loophole will outlive all of us. There have been attempts to have standalone pieces of legislation addressing just that, right, that have also failed?
There have certainly been pieces of legislation introduced. Senator Warren actually has a bill that's a broad reform of the private equity industry known as the Stop Wall Street Looting Act. And that includes a provision that would not simply reform, but end the carried interest loophole. But as you say, this is a very divided Senate, and it's hard to get small things done, let alone big ones.
Well, where can people find out more about this carried interest tax loophole and efforts to close it? Give out some information for Americans for Financial Reform, Carter.
Sure. So Americans for Financial Reform is a coalition of over 200 groups, consumer advocates, labor groups, community activists, faith groups that are dedicated to reforming the financial system. And we have created a website called stopwallstreetlooting.org, stopwallstreetlooting.org, that explains some of this in more detail. You can also sign up to our email list. You can also go to our website, ourfinancialsecurity.org. That's ourfinancialsecurity.org. And there you'll find all sorts of information. But again, a great way to do it is to join our email list and get the regular updates about what's going on and what you can do to help make this change, because this will only ever happen if we band together to make the change.
Thank you so much, Carter, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Carter Doherty. He's the Communications Director at Americans for Financial Reform. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Reproductive rights activists are eyeing the resounding victory for abortion access in Kansas, where a week ago, nearly 60% of voters defeated a ban on the politicized medical procedure. Now, the Fairness Project is seeking to replicate such an approach, using state-by-state ballot measures to restore the right that Supreme Court justices stripped away earlier this year. My guest is Kelly Hall, Executive Director of the Fairness Project. Welcome to the program, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
So give us a brief overview of what happened in Kansas. How was it that that an abortion ban was even put on the ballot?
Well, I think that Kansas is a classic example of the large distance between where the voters and the electorate are and increasingly where their more extremist legislators are. This was a legislative plan that backfired on the extreme conservatives in the Kansas legislature. They thought their time had come to formally strip abortion rights out of the Kansas Constitution. Those elected leaders voted to put that question in front of voters, and they were very sorely surprised, it seems, to see that what they viewed as the political landscape within their own chambers was not actually reflected in the electorate, as we saw from last week's resounding vote against the ballot measure.
So what one of the things that came up was that polls leading up to this election didn't capture what ended up happening. Is that because this ballot measure actually brought in less than likely voters, if you will?
Well, that analysis is ongoing, and I think this is going to be a really exciting thing for ballot measure nerds like myself and advocates around the country to analyze. But one of the things that is incredibly clear is that the turnout for a primary ballot, a primary election in an off year, was astronomically higher this year because of this ballot initiative than it otherwise was predicted to be. Almost four times as many people voted in this election as were predicted based on historical turnout models. So that really tells us not only how animated voters are on this issue, but also that it's going to be hard to predict how the issue of abortion plays into turnout in the midterm elections, on future ballot measures, and as red state legislatures continue to make this a political plank of their movement, how voters respond in turn.
Turnout was
the big surprise.
Right. And we've seen national polls showing that the access to abortion remains popular. But of course, state by state, how that pans out is not clear, but there was some analysis done by one major paper, I believe it was the Washington Post, that showed that if the ballot measure that Kansas voters voted on nationally had been voted on by the entire country, that four out of five states would have ended up backing the right to an abortion and defeating an abortion ban. So how does that lead to trying to extrapolate the success of Kansas to the rest of the country?
Well, first I'll say I am absolutely enthusiastically over the moon about the result in Kansas. And I also think it's a little bit too simplistic to imagine that what is actually going to happen in what happened in Kansas could be mirror replicated in states around the country. And also the analysis that was done to sort of predict how voters would vote was based purely on their partisan affiliation and whether or not they voted for Democrats or Republicans in the last presidential election. And I think one of the things we should really take away from Kansas is that that campaign very successfully separated the issue they were asking voters to vote on from partisan identities. And that has been the success of many other progressive-leaning issue ballot measures in what are usually considered red states. When voters in red states have been asked to vote on Medicaid expansion or raising the minimum wage or ending predatory payday lending or things that are often associated with the Democratic Party or the progressive wing of the political spectrum, when those campaigns are successful, like Kansas was, in saying, here's how you can think about this issue with your partisan hat taken off. Here's what it means for us. Here's what it means for us uniquely as a state. Voters vote yes on protecting reproductive rights, on expanding Medicaid, on raising the minimum wage. And so I would say to the folks who did the broader analysis of here's how Democrats or Republicans would vote, is say there is a lot of hope to be seen from Kansas, but it really hinges on us doing exactly the opposite of what that analysis assumed, which is we need to be looking at this through a nonpartisan lens, a bipartisan lens, and have odd bedfellows coalitions bringing together nonpartisan messages to voters if we want to put this stuff on the ballot.
Where else is an abortion ban on the ballot? And is it just what you're seeing so far, just asking voters to vote on a ban or asking voters to affirm the right to an abortion? Because those are slightly different things. The yes vote versus no vote is different.
Exactly. So in Kansas, they were voting on whether to strip a right to abortion away and sort of give the question back to the legislature, should we ban abortion in a future moment? The really exciting news is that there are three states this fall, in November of 2022, where voters will be offered the opportunity to affirmatively protect abortion rights by voting yes, there should be a constitutional right to abortion in our state. Two of those were placed on the ballot by legislatures in California and Vermont to affirm what has already been protected in statute in those states. The one that is the true battleground is in Michigan, where there is a 1931 law on the books that would criminalize the provision of abortion. There is a temporary injunction from the courts against that law going into effect, but we don't know how long that will last. And so advocates in Michigan have taken the approach of wanting to affirmatively put a right to reproductive freedom in their constitution. It's being led by phenomenal advocates on the ground who turned in a record number of signatures to qualify for that for the ballot in July. And that is something that voters can expect to see on their ballot in November in a state where this issue really could go either way if left to the hands of politicians. And it's why it's so important that citizens are taking the initiative themselves and establishing a constitutional right through a ballot initiative.
Going to the other two states, California and Vermont, isn't it risky to put on the ballot a measure that's already, or a right that's already affirmed in the state constitution? I mean, we've seen in states like California, where I'm based, Proposition 8 around same-sex marriage, which was narrowly, you know, voted down by the voters in the state. Maybe it was because of misinformation or whatnot, but why risk it if a right is already enshrined in the state constitution or seen as enshrined? Why risk putting it on the ballot?
Well, I think that that's a strategic question for the leadership of the Democratic Party and the legislature and Governor Newsom in California. This was a really concerted effort to reaffirm California as a safe haven where abortion access will not be infringed. I think
reaffirmed to whom, though? I mean, the residents of the state know it.
Yeah, I think the opportunity in Michigan is the one that is much more urgent, much more changes the state of play on the ground. We are also, I think, really supportive of opportunities to understand how different approaches need to be taken in different places. And I think you'll see a big difference between the type of campaign that was run in Kansas to what will be run in Michigan to surely what will be run in Vermont and California, which you rightly note are really different, not just political landscapes, but legal landscapes around abortion. And so to sort of extrapolate from one campaign to say, here's how it's going to look in all of the other places, is not quite right. Every state on this issue, both politically and legally, is unique. And the space that we're occupying as, you know, the Fairness Project, which is much more focused on citizen-initiated ballot measures, where we support people coming together, advocates coming together, and doing something that their legislative bodies otherwise will not do, is the place where we're focusing most of our energy and where we think the big opportunity is moving forward, not just this November, but in states around the country where it's been made clear that there is this huge disconnect between the legislature, the governor, and what the electorate likely really wants.
Right, because the state legislature and governor can play politics to, you know, draw more people to the polls. Maybe they think that putting it on the ballot will encourage voters. So tell me more about the Fairness Project and how citizen-led measures can be a way to restore this right that has been eroded. We're already seeing such horrific stories coming out of states where the procedure that we used to take for granted has been banned. You know, desperate people who are having to travel hundreds of miles that they can't even afford to do in order to access a procedure in states. So we're all, you know, progressives are often on the defensive. How can the ballot measure process, citizen-led ballot measure process, be used to go on the offensive to restore this right?
Well, I love that question because that is absolutely the script flipping that we are hoping will happen. And it's happened on other issues that we've worked on. So the Fairness Project, we live and breathe citizen-initiated ballot measures. It's our theory of change. There's plenty of ways to make a difference in this world, but our view is too often the issues that matter most to working families and to people disenfranchised from our broader political system are stuck in recalcitrant, polarized legislatures where the views of citizens on issues affecting wages, benefits, healthcare, fundamental reproductive rights, and issues of economic mobility are not the priorities of corporate lobbyists and therefore are not the priorities of legislatures. And so the work that we do is to help local advocates, the state level and the municipal level, know how the ballot measure works, how they can wield it and support them both financially, but more with just thought partnership, co-piloting, and expertise to make sure that when progressives put these issues on the ballot, they win. And the biggest script flipping example that we've had is on Medicaid expansion. You know, a few years ago, it was Obamacare was viewed as deeply unpopular all over the country. Red state legislatures were saying over my dead body. We've now had six successful citizen-initiated ballot measures in places from Idaho to Oklahoma to Missouri to Maine saying, no, thank you, Republican legislatures. We will take matters into our own hands and provide healthcare to our neighbors. And I think that is the opportunity that exists with reproductive rights as well, and any issue where there is this huge disconnect between what legislatures are doing and what the public is demanding. And so I wish it were possible everywhere. There's only 22 states plus Washington, D.C. around the country that have a citizen-initiated ballot measure process. You're based in California, so am I. Our team is spread across the country in ballot measure states. But we in California are used to seeing dozens of ballot measures on our ballot every election. We're sort of unique. Most other ballot measure states see one or two questions a year. And so part of what we're able to do is help advocates in those states where this is not a regular run-of-the-mill thing, access that tool of direct democracy and wield it in the way that can have the biggest impact.
And we've also seen, because California has so many ballot measures, it become this like contest of who can spend more money to put, you know, misinformation laden ads right up until the very last minute to change the outcome, to confuse voters, which of course is a risk in some of these other states as well.
I mean, all of the risks associated with participating in democracy in any form are also present in participating in ballot measures. There's no silver bullet that makes it a clean and easy process to make major change. So the same tactics that we see in candidate politics of disinformation and large spending on both sides, we do see in the ballot measure space. You saw all of the coverage out of Kansas last week of exceedingly misleading texts being sent to voters saying that a yes vote was the way to protect reproductive rights when in fact the opposite was true. And that was funded by, you know, a firm owned and affiliated with Republican lawmakers. And so that type of underhanded misinformation can and does happen. It's part of why it's so important to have a marriage in these efforts between the incredible community organizing and grassroots organizing and you know, really well-funded campaigns of paid communication so that the truth can come out and can be the thing that prevails. And I'm so glad that that is what happened in Kansas, that marriage between strong on-the-ground community organizing and a really well-funded paid communications campaign. And that's really the beauty of what ballot measures allow is the both and approach to politicking. And even in California, that's possible, but especially in smaller states, Midwestern states, red states, where it's not as huge of a media monstrosity as trying to communicate in California, it is possible to run those really comprehensive campaigns.
Give out a website, Kelly, for the Fairness Project.
It is thefairnessproject.org.
I will post a link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Kelly Hall. She is the executive director of the Fairness Project. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. When historian Robin D.G. Kelly published his seminal book, Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, in 2002, he hoped to inspire the racial justice activists of that time to find hope in the ideas of visionaries like Malcolm X and C.L.R. James. Well, poet and activist Aja Monet writes in the foreword of the new 20th anniversary edition of Freedom Dreams, quote, 20 years later, the truths revealed in Kelly's book remain relevant and necessary, especially in the thick, paralyzing despair of a global pandemic. Robin D.G. Kelly is a professor in the Department of African American Studies, Distinguished Professor of History, and the Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He joins me to discuss the 20th anniversary republication of his book, Freedom Dreams. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you, Sonali. It's so great to be with you always.
So 2002, I mean, two decades ago, doesn't seem like that long ago. But of course, we were in a very different time, especially on racial justice. Take us back to that time and give me a sense in your words of what prompted you, what motivated you to write this book that was your interpretation and your kind of presenting of the ideas of these radicals from previous decades for the activists of 2002.
Right. No, yes, thanks. You know, it's funny because this is a very different time and in many ways is deja vu. You know, we just witnessed the end of the so-called war in Afghanistan. You know, and in fact, that was a moment when the war, at least formally, began. This is like right around 9/11. This is a period when we had spent a lot of time, the decade before that, not before that, but years before that, fighting the Clinton administration, fighting neoliberalism, fighting, you know, so-called welfare reform, you know, defending LGBTQ IA rights. I mean, you know, was in basically struggling for prison abolition. This is the beginnings of the days of critical resistance and the prison moratorium project and these sorts of things. So at the same time, you know, what prompted the book, besides having spoken and written about police violence, was the killing of Amadou Diallo and the fact that those who killed him, you know, this is a, for those who don't recall that, an immigrant from Guinea who was shot to death by police when he held his hands up and had a wallet in his hands, and they assumed it was a gun, or at least they said that. And after the officers were exonerated, we marched down Fifth Avenue, thousands and thousands of people. In that scene, I recall February 2000 was very much what we witnessed, maybe on a slightly smaller scale, in spring 2020. So in many ways, it was kind of deja vu, but one of the things that I think was really different was the sense of despair among young people. I was teaching at NYU in Columbia at the time. Young people who really, really wanted to be active, really, really were involved in struggle, but didn't have a lot of models. The models they knew were the ones we always looked to. And I was teaching courses on Black social movements and decided to sort of turn this into a book. I also had given a talk at Dartmouth where I was sort of reflecting on Dr. King's legacy, but also really thinking about all the movements in the shadow of that legacy that picked up that legacy and really demanded a deeper social transformation, not just of the US, but the world. You know, so that was really the context for that moment.
And as we've said, and as you write about in the new introduction of this 20th anniversary edition, much has changed. In particular, just about 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, we had a massive racial justice uprising. You know, setting the book aside, can you put that into context as a historian now 2 years later of how significant that moment was and your sense of how some of that sentiment, at least among the general population, has waned?
Right. Well, you know, in terms of scale, there's a difference between 5,000 people walking up Fifth Avenue and 26 million people coming onto the streets. The killing of George Floyd, caught on film, alongside the killing of Breonna Taylor, not caught on film, in Ahmaud Arbery, these were sort of the tip of the iceberg of a whole series of state killings of Black people, unarmed Black people, by the state and by vigilantes, that really escalated during the Obama years. And again, this reflects back to the fact that under the Clinton years, as well as under the Obama years, sometimes the most intense struggles against racial violence, gendered violence, for justice emerge in opposition to liberal regimes. So here we are with an unprecedented scale, a deeply expansive, multiracial, global movement, which quickly, got blowback, you know. So alongside this emergent movement, in the midst of a shift from Obama liberalism to Trump fascism, though carrying some of the same policies, and that's another conversation, there's a real sense of a state of emergency. You know, a lot of those people came out to the streets weren't just concerned about state violence, they were concerned about capitalism, about the environment, about the potential destruction of the planet, fossil fuels, climate change. They were concerned about violence against transgender people. I mean, it was
just a multiracial uprising, it was a multi-issue uprising, but with racial justice at its center?
Absolutely. And this happens a lot, where racial justice issues, especially, you know, anti-Black violence, becomes the sort of vanguard, opening up other kinds of struggles. So those struggles were there. You know, they were there before. They became amplified, and then they got blowback. And so one of the tragedies of that moment was, because there was a deeply anti-fascist response to Trumpism, there was a tendency on the part of some of the more liberal elements to basically say, look, we need to stop making demands to abolish the police. the kinds of radical demands that came up. And again, they're not new, but they really were amplified in spring of 2020 to abolish the police, to abolish prisons, to basically come up with a completely new system of community safety that dealt with racial and gendered violence, you know, and all of that, and also dealt with security. Because again, what was different, I got to mention this, is the fact we're also in the middle of a pandemic that had a deleterious effect, not just on our physical health and mental health, but on the health of the economy globally. So these were really precarious times. So in our effort to try to push Trump out, we ended up suppressing the radical vision, the freedom dreams that erupted in that moment in exchange for a Biden-Harris ticket. And that not only dulled some of the radical elements of the movement, but at the same time, a lot of us, I didn't say everyone, but some people weren't expecting the kind of fascist response of the Capitol Rebellion in January 6th. And so here we are dealing with the kind of white backlash, as it were, you know, in response to what was basically decades of struggle for social justice and against state-sanctioned racial violence.
Tell me about, for this 20th anniversary edition now, which comes 2 years after this mass uprising, this mass historic uprising, tell me about your decision to have Aja Monet, a poet, write the foreword to your book. And if that is linked to the racial justice uprising, which has been led by a lot of young and radical Black and brown folks, but especially young Black folks.
Aja Monet is special. She is an activist. She's one of the key leaders and dream defenders. She's a poet, an artist, performer, writer. And I really honestly didn't think of anyone else but her to write a foreword. In fact, not only was she a deep reader of the text, she was in the middle of a reading group that had been spending a lot of time with Freedom Dreams, and we were in conversation, and she really understood the book. Not only that, but you know, when people read it, they'll learn that she and her comrades actually enacted something that I had imagined, but of course she wasn't aware of it. That is the idea of maroon poets. She created a maroon poetry festival and did everything in organizing that festival that I imagine the maroon poets would do as a revolutionary insurgency. So she was ideal. A poet makes perfect sense in a book that that centers on poetry as revolutionary practice. You know, the book was unusual in that I had a chapter on surrealism as part of a Black radical tradition, which is something that, you know, wasn't talked about a lot before 2002. And so in many ways, she embodies the spirit, the collective consciousness, the engagement with social movements, everything that produces Freedom Dreams.
Robin D.G. Kelly, I'm wondering if you can read an excerpt from the new introduction to the 20th anniversary publication of your book, Freedom Dreams, A Black Radical Imagination.
I'd be happy to. Okay. In the face of growing pessimism, Freedom Dreams may come across as too hopeful and optimistic in these dark times, but the book is hardly optimistic. In fact, the word optimism never appears in the book, only optimistic in the title of Jane Cortez's poem, which is a critique of being cheerful and optimistic in the face of catastrophe. Nor does the word pessimism appear, although pessimistic comes up once in describing the post-emancipation generation's outlook on the future. When I use the word hope, it does not mean wishful thinking or even dreaming. The Black radical imagination is not a kind of dream state conjured and nurtured independent of the day-to-day struggle on the ground, but rather is forged in collective movements. My central point is that we cannot divorce critical analysis from social movements. The challenges of solidarity and a deep understanding of the mechanisms of oppression generate the conditions and requirements for new modes of analysis, new ways of being together. Therefore, it is not enough to imagine a world without oppression, especially since we don't always recognize the ways in which we ourselves practice and perpetuate oppression. We must also understand the mechanisms or processes that not only reproduce subjugation and exploitation, but make them common sense and render them natural or invisible.
And that is Robin D.G. Kelly reading from the new introduction to his book Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, whose 20th anniversary publication by Beacon Press is out. Robin, one of the things that I get from what you just read was that deep analysis is required. And that seems to be something that has set apart this new chapter in racial justice, that the demands, the asks, are for the obvious, which is, of course, ending police brutality and re-envisioning how we think about public safety, but also the not so obvious, which is that all of this, these systems are part of a broader capitalist framework that needs to be deeply examined. So that deep analysis, how important is it for people who are invested in the movement for racial justice to explore that? Right. You know, it's easy to walk on the street and march with a sign. It's a lot more difficult to sustain movements. Right.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because the whole book is about the not so obvious and about the sources of new ideas. So in many ways, this book is against punditry. I'm so tired of pundits, because the idea of punditry is that someone who's supposed to be really smart gets on some media and starts spouting out about, you know, what needs to be done or why this is the case.
Or and I think worse, what they think will happen, which can be right. So limiting to our imagination.
Absolutely. They're going to predict what's next. And then they get so many likes if they can get it right. But the fact is, social movements are the incubators of new knowledge. This is the point of the book. And this is what we saw spring 2020, that, you know, part of what I was trying to suggest is that what erupted after George Floyd's murder was the manifestation of a decade or two decades of organizing, thinking, reflecting, and more organizing. The idea to abolish the police seems like a pipe dream, but when you think about it in terms of the kind of deep analysis, it makes perfect sense. When you think about the relationship between policing and housing insecurity, and the utter failure of our medical system to keep people safe, you know, or to charge people a lot of money to be able to get basic medicines. I mean, all these things are tied together, they're bound up together. And part of what emerges from these social movements is a critique of the way that racial capitalism basically is the foundation for all of these systems. How colonialism is a basis for all these systems. And so what we end up seeing is what you don't see. That is the hard work of thinking through the problems we're faced with, but seeing the links between them so that we don't simply say we want body cams, you know, or we want better training for police officers, or somehow we would like to have you know, a reduction in the cost of our prescription drugs. We need single payer healthcare. We need to end capitalism itself. We need to end these forms of state violence as a whole and see how they're all tied together. I mean, so that's what I think movements teach us. And they're not necessarily trying to predict the future, but make the future based on their understanding of reality.
And so as a historian of social movements, looking back, as your book suggests, is also important to help be inspired by how to look forward. So how do the visions of Black radicals from the, you know, civil rights era, the post-civil rights era, the Pan-Africanist era, those visionaries like Malcolm X, how did their ideas remain relevant to today?
Well, you know, I think there are two things. One is that a lot of their ideas, and when I say they, I'm referring less to the well-known figures, and that's Beacon's marketing. They like to name names, but I'm talking about the people who are really unnamed, the grassroots members of the Revolutionary Action Movement, those who fought for reparations in the late 19th and early 20th century, the activists who were part of the Combahee River Collective, who were part of the Black feminist insurgencies throughout the 20th century, people whose names we kind of know, sometimes don't know. And I think for them, the lesson is, it isn't so much the way that we can lift their ideas and project them forward. It's the way that they understood their conditions at the moment and tried to push past those conditions to imagine a solution that was more permanent. In other words, that was more revolutionary.
And actually,
how they got there.
I'm so glad you brought up the Revolutionary Action Movement. Most of us have not heard of this grouping. It was semi-underground. But are there lessons in the formation of such movements? Because one of the things you do in your book is create the backdrop that we can imagine had to have been there in order for groups like this to emerge, the conversations that led to them, the circumstances, some of which are very different from today and some of which are not so different, right?
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that the Revolutionary Action Movement's history speaks to is why the kind of periodization that we have adopted, that is, civil rights begets Black power, begets all these different things. The RAM was formed really in 1962 in the middle of what we think of as the heyday of civil rights. They were not a civil rights organization. They were a revolutionary action organization. Their politics were inspired not only by the long history of things like Reconstruction in the 19th century, but by what was happening in China, what was happening in African liberation movements, what was happening in the Caribbean. Their perspective was global.
Well, finally, Robin, are you hopeful for the next few years, given that, as we talked about earlier, the backlash to the 2020 racial justice mass uprising was swift, was diluted by the Biden-Harris administration, you know, Biden very openly being pro-police, and, you know, people aligning behind him because Trump. What can you, as a historian, I'm sort of asking you to do some punditry here reluctantly, what can you say about the next few years for racial justice?
Well, I can't do punditry, but I can say is this. Hopeful, I would say determined, because we really don't have a choice. Mm. We don't have a choice. We can't think of anything but trying to figure out a way to stop this catastrophe. Now, here are two things. One, we have been here before. For some of us, for your descendants, my descendants, we've already faced ongoing fascism that wasn't called that. So we've been here before. For a lot of white people, middle-class white people, this is new. Like, they've not experienced this before. And so we don't really have a choice. You know, there will be crimes and misdemeanors and people will be prosecuted, but to me, that's not the bigger issue. The bigger issue is, how do we return back to those revolutionary visions, to not just punish people who have tried to steal elections and hold power, but completely revamp power, take power, power to the people to transform this society into something that is actually livable, that's based on love and community, and really based on the abolition of all forms of oppression. That's the ask. And we have to do that, because if we don't do that, we won't be here in several generations. There will be no planet.
I want to thank you so much, as always, Robin, for joining us today. Best of luck to you for the 20th anniversary edition of your book, Freedom Dreams.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Robin D.G. Kelly. He is a professor in the Department of African American Studies, Distinguished Professor of History, and the Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA. And his pathbreaking and highly acclaimed 2002 book, Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, has just been republished by Beacon Press on its 20th anniversary. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatka. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.